Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Hello, everyone. I have a special guest on today. Her name is Lynn Smith Gregory. She was raised in a Mormon family in Utah, closely related to the church's founder, Joseph Smith. Growing up, she struggled with perfectionism and the fear of a violent father. Disillusioned by her discoveries about the history of her family and her religion, she left her faith and family to find herself. Despite academic success, she grappled with guilt and remnants of familial trauma, eventually leading her to re-examine her truth. Currently residing in Savannah, Georgia, Lynn is working on a memoir about the consequences of leaving the Mormon Church as a Smith herself. The book, tentatively titled We Were Smiths, will provide an in-depth look into a family torn apart by secrets, discord, and a burdensome legacy. Here is Lynn now. It is my absolute pleasure to have Lynn Smith Gregory with me today. Thank you so much. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Rachel, for having me. I'm excited to be here.
I would love to get into a lot of different subjects, but if you don't mind just spending a few moments introducing yourself for people who might not know about what brings you to being interested in this to begin with.
Well, in case you're viewers or listeners don't know, I am the great-great-grandniece of Joseph Smith, who is the founder of the Mormon Church, also known as the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And I left the church at 19 when, through my research and reading, discovered that the narrative I had been told by the church all my life and that I believed in devoutly simply wasn't true. And I know some people don't think of the Mormon church as a cult, but I think that it meets all the requirements.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I would love to get into that with you. You know, just as an aside, there are a lot of times that I will learn about a particular group and about the nature of it when people, let's say, have heard me talk about cultic groups in general, and then they'll call me and say, you know, actually, this sort of hits all the points. And it was the same thing, actually, where people started alerting me to when they were in relationships and or raised by narcissists. I'm like, And so I was able to then expand my awareness and kind of expand my reach to have kind of a wider umbrella over a lot of groups that are considered truly valid mainstream organizations. And people just don't know what could also be woven in, which is what we're going to talk about today. So maybe let's start there. What are the points that it hits that alerted you to the fact that maybe it could qualify as a cultic group?
Well, I've actually put a blog out, my newsletter, about how to tell if your organization or religion is a cult, identifying some of the characteristics that cults have in common. And in doing that, I realized just how closely the controls and restrictions of the Mormon religion met the criteria. For example, and I think this is really key, there's absolutely no acceptable reason to leave the Mormon church. None. If you're leaving, it's because Satan has led you astray, or you've decided you can't measure up to the standards and requirements of membership, and you want to go off and be a sinful person. So there's no way to leave with your dignity intact.
Right. So that really does mean no matter what's happened to you, no matter really anything.
Yeah, no acceptable reason for leaving.
Incredible. Incredible. Okay. And so, and I'm wondering, actually, before we go into you leaving at 19, are there other things that you think distinguish it from, let's say, a mainstream religion or a healthy organization itself?
Well, the other things that I think check the boxes in cult status is that they profess to have a monopoly on the truth. They are the one and only source of truth and the one and only path to God. And so also the Mormon Church believes they have a living prophet, meaning someone who runs the church who is in direct communication with God. And that makes him infallible because God is infallible. So that leads us to the other aspects, which is a complete intolerance for criticism of the leader or leaders, and also a complete intolerance for questioning any of the practices, dogma, or instructions from church leaders. There's also the insistence that the church is the priority over family. And the Mormon Church, particularly in Utah, where they have the numbers to do this very effectively, Mormons live in a bubble. They isolate their young members from other non-members or Gentiles, as Mormons call everybody else who's not a Mormon, which is another cult characteristic. You know, you're not allowed to date outside the religion, or really even socializing is discouraged unless you're trying to convert them. And absolutely no marriage outside the church. So it's an isolating experience. If you go up in Utah, you are really under the illusion that you're the majority. And I certainly grew up thinking that I wasn't a cult. All these weird splinter groups might be considered cults. The Mormons who still practice polygamy, et cetera. And we can get into that, but that might be another conversation. But I felt like I was in the majority, and my isolation and the mentality of keeping members completely busy from Saturday all the way through Saturday. There's a meeting or an activity at the church every day. So it consumes all your time. You don't have a lot of time to get experience or perspective out in the real world.
Right. You know, this idea also that it's more important than family wreaks havoc in families and causes a lot of pain and a lot of division and estrangement, as we're going to talk about. It's reminding me of this idea by Robert J. Lifton, this idea that within cultic groups and controlling groups, there's doctrine over person. So the doctrine, the theology, the adherence to the group is everything over any other relationship. And so I sometimes imagine it that the church, the people in charge, the building, whatever you picture as the church, is squarely between you and your spouse, even, or between your children and your parents, right there, right in the middle. You have to kind of figure out how to then navigate your life with that squarely in the middle, knowing that if it makes a decision for you, that's what you have to follow, even if it means leading you away from your loved ones.
Yeah, that is really one of the great tragedies that we're seeing played out, especially right now, In the past, parents have disowned their children if they've left the church, which is terribly sad. But the church's position on homosexual LGBTQ issues have led to a hemorrhaging in the Mormon church because, for example, my little sister, with her 9 children and devout Mormon lifestyle, had a dilemma when her beloved son came out as gay. And he was beloved in the family as the peacemaker, the kindest, most gentle soul in the family. And she couldn't accept that this child of hers that she loved and respected so much was considered an abomination in God's eyes. And neither could her other children. And so with his coming out, she and the rest of her kids, except for one, all left the church.
Oh my goodness. Oh, I got goosebumps. That is a very powerful move. And how lucky for, right, for your nephew, who got to experience that people's love for him mattered more or the most here. Wow.
Correct.
Wow. Okay. Very, very beautiful. Because I, you know, as a therapist, I often deal with the fallout from the decision being quite the opposite.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
And it's heartbreaking to me. Because while the Mormon church spends millions of dollars on its image as this very wholesome, happy family culture, the reality is that if you don't meet the criteria, you're hidden away. It's not an inclusive religion. Until 1974, African Americans could not hold the priesthood, which is the power to act in God's name that all Mormon men are given at the age of 14. So it was a racist organization, and they really only resolved it by having a direct revelation from God, supposedly to allow Blacks to hold the priesthood. But the fact of the matter was it was interfering with their proselytizing efforts in Africa and other countries. Even though there's 17.2 million Mormons worldwide, Utah is predominantly Mormon. And it's I call it Wonder Bread Land, you know, white middle-class Mormons who all look like they've been cut out with the same cookie cutter. It doesn't embrace diversity, a variety of opinions, or particularly any non-traditional roles for not only women, but anyone with gender or sexual preferences. So that, to me, is heartbreaking. And the younger members of the church are leaving primarily because the Mormon church's rigid stance on this. The church is hemorrhaging young people. They find it unacceptable that in this day and age, they have such incredibly backward and harmful doctrines and philosophies in place.
Right. And so, you know, as it is with a lot of different groups, the media is going to focus on the more sensationalistic stories. And then the general population is going to have that vision, too. And I think about having been, in fact, I have a notice here from the Texas Department of Family and Protective Services thanking me when I went to go help with working with people who had taken off Warren Jeff's compound, working with the children. And that, I mean, talk about cookie cutter, woo, right? I mean, and just hoping that that was going to give them a chance to see that they could create a life for themselves separate from being this cutout figure. But at the same time, what you're talking about is the day-to-day, you know, the mainstream, quote-unquote, how people are treated within their family systems. And I think also just this sense we have what everyone needs, like the idea of converting people after they die, which I found out about. And as a Jew, I'm thinking, oh, this doesn't feel right, because Jews don't proselytize. We don't convert. We don't, you know, it's so the antithesis of what we even think about. And to know that people are going to be thinking they need to save us, you know, I mean, that might come from a genuine place inside.
Whether you want to be saved or not. And in fact, Jewish groups sued the Mormon Church when they discovered that the Mormon Church had baptized people who died in the Holocaust into the Mormon faith. It shows a fundamental disrespect and inability to grasp what is appropriate, and also just how incredibly driven they are with their mandate, which is to baptize everyone who's ever lived on the planet as much as possible so that they can hear the quote-unquote true gospel of that Joseph Smith proposed and accept it even after they've died. And that's what the baptism for the dead, which is why the Mormon Church has the largest genealogical database. All these Mormon volunteers go out and record Bibles, letters, birth certificates, etc., to come up with a comprehensive record so they can use it to baptize these people by proxy in temple ceremonies.
Incredible. I remember also when I was young, we were going somewhere, I don't remember, and we needed camping or something, we needed to get canned goods. And I remember my father saying, if there's a Mormon temple around here, there's going to be a store for canned goods, right? And you just knew from LA that was the case, you know, that there are these stores just preparing for the end times, right?
Right. Every member is instructed to have a 2-year supply on hand.
Wow. Incredible. Okay. So before we get into your story too, I'm just wondering also with you having this connection to Joseph Smith through your familial lineage, you know, just we often have stories that are passed down from generation to generation, whether it is accurate or a game of telephone. It's hard to know after a while. But what have you heard about him just as a person separate from this? Have there been any stories told?
Well, there were stories told by my devout parents. In fact, they were often told to me in the same vein as parents telling their children myths or fairy tales. It was like, oh, we have the real deal because you're related to the first prophet, the founder of the Mormon faith, and your great-great-grandfather was the first member or convert to the church. And they were talked about in hallowed tones. And what I felt was an incredible burden to live up to my legacy and to make them proud of me. We were positioned in our church and community as the perfect Mormon family because of our blood connection to Joseph Smith, and held up as an example to emulate. So there was incredible pressure to be perfect. And I talk about that in my memoir and what the repercussions were when my sister and I both, for different reasons and in different ways, left the Mormon Church about the same time, and how that impacted the family, because we spent a lot of time and energy on our public persona, and this was absolutely not supposed to happen to our family. So it was an embarrassment, and I felt compelled to leave Utah where I wouldn't shame my family. And so I moved to New York City, sight unseen, after I graduated from college. I was in college when I discovered the truth about the Mormon Church. And so there wasn't any place for me to be an acceptable member of the family in Utah. And I was estranged from my family, basically, for decades. And I talk about what happened as my family imploded with my sister and mine's departure in my book.
Yeah. And I want people certainly to buy your book. And we're going to talk about that at the end, about where people can find it. I want them to be able to dive into all of this and these stories. You know, I've worked with a number of people who were these legacy families, people who, children, grandchildren, and then some of the leadership, and sometimes sharing the same last name. And sometimes people are really enamored with them and sometimes jealous of them, but it's not an easy existence at all. And I think people do not realize the standard by which they are held, the mirror held up to them, the inability to move outside of the expectations, and knowing also what is going to crumble should they just decide to have a life that is based upon the information as they see it now and as they're synthesizing it now and based upon a new set of truths, you know?
Yes. It's integral to your identity. I was special because of my relationship to the founder. And to lose my specialness and my family, my religion, my community. I mean, the decision to leave, I mean, my whole world had crumbled because I found out that not only was he not, shouldn't be revered as someone next to Jesus Christ, which is how the Mormon Church thinks of Joseph Smith. I mean, he was a bad guy. He was a con artist, a fraud, a liar, a cheat, a predatory womanizer. I mean, he preyed on girls as young as 14 who were in his household under his protection. And I mean, I went from being so proud of something to being absolutely humiliated and ashamed of this connection. And it took me a long time to try to find my footing. I had thought that maybe I could just leave it all behind when I left Utah and pull a geographic and move to New York and reinvent myself anew. But of course, that's not how trauma works. And so it took a lot of deconstructing and a lot of therapy and time and patience to work through all the ways that my indoctrination was still impacting my life.
Okay, so let's talk about that, because to make such a big change at age 19 is asking a lot of really anyone as they're just beginning to be adults in the world, and to go from being the relative of to suddenly just being Lynn, you know? And then there is some lovely kind of peacefulness about that, where you get to just create a self, right? And kind of step into the world as, hey, this is me, and I get to just be me, and people can meet me for me. But, you know, you can feel like I have this invisible crown, like I'm not sure where to put it, right? Do I put it down? Do I hold on?
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, I tried to leave it behind, but, you know, as a therapist, you know that when something is unconscious, it can still be running the show. And I didn't realize how much, because I was born into a cult. So I believe we are hostages to our parents' worldview and orientation to the world. and tell you systematically, thoroughly, methodically, break down what that means, it's still really impacting. And you were easily triggered by things and not really sure why until you have time to pause and reflect on why that's the case.
Right. Right. So, I'm actually curious about that. So what were the triggers that you noticed? I know this is going, you know, kind of getting back into your headspace at the time, but what were the triggers for you?
Well, I mean, I had decided if Joseph Smith was a fraud, that maybe the whole idea of God was a myth as well. In a very 19-year-old fashion, I said, well, if the Mormon Church isn't true, the whole idea of God is probably a myth. And I became an atheist. And that created a certain sense of freedom, but also it was after the certainty of Mormon answers, there were suddenly no rules governing the world. Everything was permissible. I didn't have any guidelines or even a way to look at the world, a framework, a scaffolding. But I mean, when I would swear, I mean, I would have that instant knee-jerk reaction of a flush, like, oh my God, I just said God out loud. It, you know, I took the Lord's name in vain, you know, almost like looking up at the sky, expecting lightning to strike you down. And for everything, and there were so many things we weren't supposed to do, not drink, not even drink coffee, you know, tea or an alcohol. And so every time I crossed one of those lines or broke one of those rules, it was very deliberate and very thought out. And I had to fight the wave of guilt and shame, reminding myself that these were old childhood tapes in my head that I didn't believe anymore. But it was still very challenging. And those were the obvious ones. The more subtle ones are when you're triggered by things. I mean, it's been decades now since I left the church. But for example, when I went to see the Book of Mormon play, I'm in the audience and everyone around me is laughing hysterically at how stupid and funny and absurd these Mormons are, who are, you know, what the play's about. And I found myself upset because these people were laughing at what Mormons considered to be sacred. And I realized that on some level, I was identifying as a Mormon. And I couldn't believe it, that after all these years, I couldn't be in on the joke and see it in a, and I probably never will be able to see it as a regular person, you know, somebody who never was in the church. But even more insidious was the discovery years after I left the church, an incident happened, and I talk about it in the book, and I went into a clinical depression, and I couldn't make sense of it until unraveling the thread that I felt somehow that God was punishing me for my depression, was punishment for daring to leave the church, and more importantly, daring to be happy without his approval. And I didn't get that connection until I couldn't figure it out. And that helped me understand what was going on. How dare I be happy leading this non-religious but spiritual life now and throwing off all the rules and regulations from my childhood and my faith?
My goodness, conditioning is,
I know,
right? It's so powerful. It's so powerful. I'm curious actually about that, how you were able to start to push through that, that if you don't feel deserving or right, you know, having a happy life, a happy, healthy life, what did you need to start saying to yourself, or what did you need to tell yourself in those moments to get through that?
Well, I actually have at that point abandoned my atheism for a more nuanced idea that there was possibly something bigger than myself. My sister, on the other hand, never did. She was a nihilist, you know, it's a random petri dish and nothing matters. And we live and then we die and that's it. But it wasn't explaining mystery to me, that perspective. And I had the experience of people that I truly loved who believed there was something bigger, whether they wouldn't necessarily call it God, but force, creation, the divine, even love. I mean, why do we love? Are we hardwired for love? Why? You know, is there a design in the creation of the universe? And those questions, I also started meditating and reading a lot of books that were spiritually based. And that helped me, along with therapy, understand that the idea of not being worthy was just too small. If I could expand my idea of God to be bigger than the critical, controlling, punishing God of my childhood, then I could see myself differently and accept that more of myself was acceptable, that I had a right to take up space on the planet without earning it, that we're all worthy of love and belonging and being ourselves just by virtue of our birth. And that is what I kind of held on to constantly remind myself that I didn't believe that anymore. I had to remind myself that's really not your truth anymore. And there is no big bad God up there keeping score who's going to punish me when I die.
Yeah, I, you know, a lot of people who talk to me say that they are so afraid that when they do anything or they have their first drink or anything like that, that somehow God is watching. And I think, you know, if God has so much time on their hands, just noticing the cigarette you're having, really, there isn't more happening to be watching out for, you know,
what's going on in Gaza or, you know,
whatever, right? It's like a firefighter getting a cat out of a tree. That is important, but there's a burning building next door.
Uh-huh.
Right? Right, exactly. So I do think that there is something interesting too about the idea of value, that you have this inherent value.
Yes.
Yeah. That you don't have to do anything. You don't have to prove anything. You don't have to be anything. You don't have to believe something in particular, but you could just have that as a human being. Yeah, that's a whole new idea, because I think value feels to me like in a lot of cultic systems, it's performative. You need to do something in order to get that sense that you are valued.
And that was very much true both in the church and in my family. Love was based on measuring up to certain standards. And in fact, I didn't hear the word love. It was good job, or that was acceptable, or, you know, and so I thought it was achievement was the only thing that mattered, particularly to my father. And letting go of the idea that you have to earn love or belonging or be worthy. It took a lot of looking at it carefully. And becoming a parent myself, it helped me because I could easily see that I was attributing things to that old-fashioned idea of God that would be unacceptable to me as a parent. I mean, I would have more forgiveness than this old idea of God. I mean, what, your children aren't going to be able to return home because they smoked a cigarette or had a cup of coffee? I mean, they're not going to make it into the top tier of heaven? I mean, as a parent, my love for my children made me realize how ludicrous that idea of a God was. And I could expand my definition if there was a creator or some organizing logic in the universe, that it was more benign. As Einstein said, one of the most important questions we ever ask ourselves is whether we believe the universe is friendly or hostile. And I love that idea. And I've decided it's friendly. And so I don't know what I believe. I don't have a new substitute religion, but I believe in something bigger than me that is the reason human beings are capable of love and altruism and being good people. I think we're hardwired that way. And I think that's for a reason.
Yes. And it's reminding me, you know, working with a lot of people actually who were raised in Scientology, I remember them saying to me when they were young and going to Scientology schools, and a little classmate, someone would fall, hurt themselves, need help, they would go instinctively, go over to help. And they were stopped because that was somehow interfering with that person's process. But what you notice in the story is the natural proclivity was to say, oh no, let me help you. And, you know, extend a hand to help someone up. It needs to be interfered with in order to stop it. But that is, I think, the natural way for many people, not all, but for many people just naturally before that's curtailed, which is a really good thing to know, even though, you know, it's a sad state of affairs there when that happens. But just that notion can give you a sense that the world can be probably a friendlier place than you're told it's going to be.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. Because it was a very scary place. If I didn't adhere very closely to all the commandments and guidelines and restrictions and rules, I would fall into utter darkness and be there forever. And I wouldn't be with my family in heaven. And so that was a very scary prospect. The world outside of the Mormon church was considered dangerous, scary, threatening, alien, and had no value. So it's such a limited way of seeing the world in such a negative way.
Yeah, and a really, really negative way. It feels like it's part of the conditioning. If we can paint a picture of the world being this big, bad place, then you won't want to be there and we can hold on to you here. I mean, how much do you feel that's a part of this vision that's created?
Absolutely. Proselytizing program is fairly unique among Mormons. Among religions, Mormons send out a couple of thousand missionaries every week all over the globe. And these are young men and women who are paying themselves to proselytize. They pay for themselves. Most churches sponsor missionaries, but the Mormon church, you pay for the privilege of going out to convert people to Mormonism. And like I said, there are 17.2 million Mormons globally now. And it's the fastest growing Christian, if you consider Mormons Christian. And I don't, because they have some theological issues with that designation. But they're the fastest growing Christian religion in the world.
My goodness. Because you think of all the proselytizing, or what? What is?
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, it's huge. It's extensive. Plus, there is also the pressure. The saying in the Mormon Church is every member a missionary. Your go-to mode when you meet someone who's not LDS or not a Mormon is, this is an opportunity to convert them. It's not like, wow, I wonder if this might be an interesting friendship. They're so different from me. It is, they're a potential convert.
Right, right. That happens quite a lot in a lot of groups. It's like these large group awareness training, like, let's get people to come to this transformative weekend. I have this piece of paper that, it's old. I think it was like mimeographed. It has like a blue print on it. And it was from one of these original large group awareness trainings. And it was saying the appropriate places, or the places to bring people in and show them kind of what we can offer them. And one of the things on the list was funerals. I thought, oh no, right? But that's so shameless.
Shameless.
Right? So it was every place where people congregate for any reason is fair game.
Is a
right?
potential.
Right. So I of course, I want to be able to come to, you know, estrangement, connection, community. I'm wondering for you, just as you were kind of emerging in the world and defining you, it is hard to push against the conditioned thinking and, you know, and the fears. And so what else, I think, were you thinking about just as yourself, as a woman going into the world and having a voice and having power? And what did you have to push against to feel confident?
Everything. As you are aware, the Mormon Church is heavily patriarchal in nature. Women have no leadership roles. And they are very overt and out loud about the fact that a woman's place and only place is having a family and being a helpmate to her husband. So even though Mormon, and this becomes very complex because most families can't survive on one income. So Mormon women, if they can, don't work. They stay home with the kids and have as many kids as they, God sends them, not even what they can afford. I'm one of nine children. And when you grow up not seeing any women in leadership positions or given a voice, and there's also a message that women are happiest as wives and mothers, and that anything else is unacceptable. And if you express anything contrary to that, try to color outside the lines, you are quickly put in your place. And you don't hold the priesthood, meaning you don't have the power to act in God's name. The husband is the leader of the family and makes all the important decisions. And even in the afterlife, I'm not sure everyone is aware that even though polygamy is now not practiced in the Mormon Church today, it was dropped because Utah couldn't become a state. It was a requirement for statehood. And so they said, okay, we won't do it anymore. And they had a revelation from God saying it was okay to stop the practice for now. But it is still doctrine in the Mormon Church that when you die, you're going to heaven. And if you're a really good Mormon and you've been married in the temple and done all the things you're supposed to do, you become a god. And you have multiple wives who bear you children to populate the planets that you create. So I remember thinking, let me make sure I have this right. I have to share my husband with multiple wives in heaven. That's my reward for being a good Mormon girl. Didn't sound like anything I was interested in, but that is doctrine.
Wow. Oh my goodness. Right. And the idea that women are happiest as wives and as mothers was something probably promulgated and created the notion by men.
Absolutely. And it's complex, but Utah has the highest rates of sexism in the country. So when they do surveys, they talk about sexual discrimination and those kinds of issues. But there's also internalized sexism. In Utah, when they did polls and said, which would be better, would a woman or a man be better as president of the United States? The women said, oh, it's a man's job. They've internalized. And that's heartbreaking to me. Also, there's real pressure to put on a happy face. So there's a toxic positivity culture operating where, I mean, my mother was a perfect example of, on the outside, she looked like your perfect Mormon mother. But the reality was she gave up a scholarship to Juilliard to become an opera singer to marry my father because he was a Smith, and that would guarantee her direct ascension to heaven. And so at 19, she gave it all up, married my father, gave up her dreams, and adopted his own. And she looked to the outside to be, I mean, she had a beautiful voice, so she sang in church. And my father really had high standards for what women looked like. And my mother was very proud of the fact that she weighed the same that she did when she got married, and a lot of pressure on looking good and being cheerful and happy. But we knew that when she came in the door, she was often exhausted from her church callings and trying to raise 9 children, that she suffered from migraine headaches and depression. And this is the underbelly that you don't see in the Mormon church. But the reality is women in Utah have the highest rate of antidepressant use in the country. They also have the second highest plastic surgery rate. There's a lot of pressure to look beautiful, be attractive, present this Mormon face to the world of happy, contented homemakers. And if you don't, then there's something wrong with you, which leads to of course, depression. Because when we don't think we're measuring up and we see our neighbor across the street, well, she's got 2 more kids than me and she seems to be handling it fine. What am I not doing? I'm not being righteous enough. That's internal tape that's going on. And I saw it play out in my Mormon brothers and sisters. The effects of that kind of patriarchy and the limitations for women in terms of who they could be and what kind of authority and voice they had.
Incredible. It's very sad. I mean, it's very sad to think about people needing to put on a false front, literally false front, with plastic surgery and also with antidepressants. That doesn't mean you're happy because you're an antidepressant. It's a way of masking, it's a way of treating, but it is something that doesn't get to the heart, of course, of
right.
The issue.
It's a symptom of a bigger problem.
Right. Exactly. Exactly right. Yeah. And I wonder then, for you coming out in the world, having an authentic feeling, you know, not ascribing to the toxic positivity necessarily. I'm sure still kind of wanting to come across like, oh, I have it together and everything's fine. Because people sometimes do that. They just do that socially. But just to have anger about something, you know, how did you develop or give yourself permission for that?
Well, I was fortunate in a way to grow up in an era of feminism, overt feminism. And I joined a women's consciousness raising group. And the women in there, in when I told my story, they were outraged for me. And it was only by listening to how outraged they were for me that I got in touch with my own anger about it. It was like, oh, I guess I should be upset about that. You're right. And it was kind of a funny process, but then I really embraced it. And I ended up going into tech, which was a very male-dominated industry. And I was sort of like, I've got something to prove. So that was kind of how I dealt with it.
Okay. Okay. Interesting. So that leads me into this next part of the conversation. And, you know, here, just knowing that you got involved in a women's group, people are looking for community. And, right, they're looking for connection. They're needing it, I think, as we're social beings. And so here you found a group of women who could validate, who could help be the mirror, right, to hold up to your experience and your stories and be outraged for you. And that's great perspective, really good perspective. But let's talk about that and the estrangement, the disconnection from a community and the need to connect. So I'd love to hear that part of your story, and also the counsel that you give other people who might be feeling isolated and what they might be needing.
Well, once again, I feel very, very fortunate that in my family, after my sister and I left the church, decades later, a couple of other members of the family left. And so the family was really divided in half. Believers and heretics. And we kind of emotionally and geographically scattered. But there was an event in the family that happened where we all got back together in a crisis situation. And as a result of that, we decided to try to do some family therapy and see if there was any path to seeing ourselves as a family from these very polar opposite positions. And so I'm very fortunate. I mean, that everybody in the family chose to participate in that, and that we were willing to gather once a year for a family reunion for 3 or 4 days. So I feel really, really lucky. But we learned in that process of therapy how to talk to each other and how to give each other the kind of acknowledgement and respect that was missing in our dialogue before. You know, if you are coming from a place of absolutes, which the Mormons were coming from, you know you have the real truth, and that whatever you think about me, I'm misguided, et cetera, et cetera. It's very hard to get past that. We still get together. In fact, we have a sibling reunion in Panama this year in February, where we're all getting together for about 5 days. And we will not be discussing religion or politics, for that matter, because we know there really isn't a way for us to discuss religion in a way that doesn't diminish the other person's perspective. I mean, if you think you've got the one and only truth that exists on the planet, and I'm saying, well, I think yours could be one of the many ways to get, I mean, there's a lot of paths up the mountain, and they're going, only one. Where do you go with from that conversation? But what we have learned to do is listen with respect as someone describes their experience, whether it's spiritual, religious, You know, so I listen to my brothers and sisters who are Mormons talk about their sons going off on missions or their daughters having their sixth child, and without comment, other than it looks like you're very excited about that and I'm happy for you. So learning to give each other the space to be who they are. And we kind of even laugh about some things, like the Mormons make fun of the fact that we treat getting coffee in the morning, really good coffee in the morning, as some sort of drug ritual. It's so important. And, you know, well, you guys make such a big deal out of that, you know, and we laugh about it because, you know, coffee is not something that Mormons do. And we make fun of them for, okay, well, we can't eat a bite of food without having a prayer here, you know?
Right? I mean, I as you're talking too, I'm thinking, well, how lovely the world would be if, right, if that were people's reactions to someone saying, I'm going to vote for this person. And the other person can say, oh, so tell me more about that. Or I could see why that would matter to you, or something lovely, you know? My goodness. Wow. What an example.
I that's why I feel, even though my book has a lot of heartbreak and tragedy in it, it ends on a hopeful note, because I believe that the polarization that exists in this country through religious or political reasons can be effectively bridged if we would just learn some basic communication skills and be willing to use them if we want a relationship. And like I say, I feel so fortunate that the Mormons and the non-Mormons both felt like staying a family or still being in touch with each other was important enough to go to therapy and meet up.
Mm-hmm. Right. And what a great example that you're setting for your children and any future generation, that you can get together with people and you can be mutually respectful, even if you have
agree to disagree.
Right, right. Oh my goodness gracious. Okay, so I'm wondering, just, I know we're kind of winding down here and there's so much to talk about. My goodness, this has been so fantastic. I'm curious just about, you know, some ideas. And then, of course, I want you to be able to talk about where people can find you and your book and what you're putting out there in the world. But for people who are listening, who are grappling with some of the questions that were coming up for you at age 19. And I think of just how significant that age is, thinking that's the year that your mom also gave up her scholarship to Juilliard. And that's when you emerged in the world. Oh my goodness. But I wonder just some ideas that you have of support or guidance for people kind of questioning now.
I didn't know of any religious trauma therapist. I didn't know such a thing existed, and it may not have, you know, at the time that I left the church. And then, of course, I leave Utah and go all the way to Manhattan, talk about culture shock. But I think that is really, really helpful. I did go to therapy. I think it's really important to find support, but also like-minded community. I didn't know one other person in New York City that was an ex-Mormon. I would have loved the idea. I did have a good friend who had left her Salvation Army church, where her parents and grandparents were very entrenched. And that was one of the reasons we bonded. And she's still my best friend today. And I met her over 40 years ago. So it's important to be able to feel not alone. So I would recommend people find, whether in person, ideally, and if not online, in ex-Mormon or other cult support groups, and have a chance to be out loud about their feelings and ask questions. Does anybody else feel this way? I think it's important to work with an individual therapist and untangle what is religious trauma, what is family dysfunction, because they get very intermingled. And I became a lot more understanding and forgiving when I realized that my parents had religious trauma. They were traumatized by the way they were raised. So what they did wrong suddenly became much easier to understand and forgive. So I could forgive my mother for when she didn't understand my need to be independent and not get married at 20, you know, blah, blah, blah. Because I could see we're talking about intergenerational trauma. And so I think that's important. And I think it's really important to be as generous and loving and patient with yourself as possible. I found that I needed to learn how to be in my body again after the purity culture of Mormonism, where my body wasn't the enemy. So for me, yoga was an important part of my healing journey. Meditation, so that I could stop the tapes from just automatically playing in my head and had a chance to examine them. Both of those were really important. Reading about other people's experiences, books, etc., etc. But patience, it takes time to heal. Be patient and generous with yourself. You didn't learn this overnight. If you were born into a cult, it's almost preverbal, visceral in your body. And understand that's a hard thing to let go of and believe. So find people who help champion you so you can champion yourself.
Ooh, that's beautiful. That's a beautiful line. That's a t-shirt right there. That's a good one. And, you know, that's part of the reason that I do this podcast, so people can hear other people's stories. Part of the reason that I do a former cult member support group for the same reason. And sometimes people will be there for the first time and wanting to tell their stories, but not knowing if what they experience is going to fit in because either they haven't been in a group or the groups that they were sent to were trauma survivors or some. It was sort of adjacent, but it wasn't necessarily
specific. Yeah.
Right. And so I've sometimes told people if they're there for the first time and they don't yet know if their story is going to connect with other people's, while people are introducing themselves, just to hold off. They can even keep their camera off and whatever and jump in if they want. And then suddenly I see after people are telling why they're there, the person almost invariably will turn their camera on and say, okay, I'm good. Okay, this is what happened to me. And there is something
I can relate. Right.
Right. Yes. I can relate. I'm not going to get stared at. I'm not going to be considered so odd, you know, and
there's safety and acceptance in this room.
Yeah. Right. So where can people find the work that you're doing, your book, all of it? Because I certainly want people to read more of your story.
Well, thank you. The book isn't out yet. It's with publishers, my agent, and they've asked me to make a few changes. So it's not available for purchase, but you can follow along with my publishing journey on my website, which is just Lynn with one N, LynnSmithGregory.com. I also have an email newsletter, which you can subscribe to, where I talk about issues that are tangential or relatable, connected in some way to Mormonism or religious trauma or family estrangement or controversies in the Mormon church. And this week, I'm launching my YouTube channel. You can probably find it under my name, but the name of my YouTube channel is Heretic Survivor, From Mormon to Me.
Oh, that is great. You're a wordsmith along with being a smith. It's been lovely to meet you, to talk to you, and I look forward to reading your book when it comes out to the public, and thank you, and feel free to come back anytime.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed our conversation, and I appreciate you having me on, and thank you for all the good work you do. As someone who has been helped, it is vital and critical and makes such a difference.
Thank you. Thank you, Lynn, for saying that. Hope to talk to you again soon.
Likewise. Take care.
One more thing before you go. Thank you so much to Lynn for her openness, for sharing with us what it's like to be a descendant of a family that is so famous and can also be seen as infamous. It's very hard to carry that around. There is this sort of guilt, this shame, this moral injury you can walk around with, feeling in some ways connected to something that was wrong. What's also true is that there are so many burdens that come with that connection. One is that you can feel a certain sense of responsibility. I know on the podcast, we've had Jamie DeWolf, the great-grandson of L. Ron Hubbard, who talks about this family legacy and what it does to him in terms of his conscience and how hard he has worked to do cult education and to expose who his great-grandfather was and what he started. And I think that that makes him feel better. I know it validates so much for so many people who hear him. But what's also true is that you're in this in-between world, because on the one hand, you very often know things to a certain degree from behind the scenes. You have family stories that are way more accurate, even though sometimes it can be hearsay, of course, and gossip, of course, but they're going to be way more accurate than the perfect vision of that relative that the church or group that they started is given. So here, you are going to walk into a building where your relative's picture is everywhere, or their name is on everything, and they're really seen as a god or mini god. But you know different. And so can you say? Can you not say? Are you supposed to keep it private? Most people do. But that doesn't actually help anyone or anything at the end of the day if what you feel in your heart is that they've started something that can be destructive. So I really value that Lynn is dealing with being part of what we sometimes call legacy families, where she shares the same last name as someone who is seen as perfect in so many people's eyes, as seen as sort of anointed by God in so many people's eyes. That absolute thinking is something I want to mention something about. Lynn talked a lot about the way she was guided to see things and the way the church was run and still is. There is black and white thinking. There isn't gray. There isn't an in-between space. There isn't a sometimes and a maybe and a it depends. There is a yes and a no. And one of the absolutes that is part of the black and white thinking is something she mentioned, which is that there is no valid reason for leaving. No valid reason for leaving. So that means anyone who leaves is doing it without reason, without cause, at least in the eyes of the people in the church. But if somebody's going to be leaving something like that, where their whole family might still be involved, where their whole community might still be involved, where everything they knew and know existed there, there is usually a very big reason to extract yourself from something like that, knowing that you're going to be often abandoned and pushed away and looked down upon, knowing that you have to grapple with your own fear of going to hell because of it, and God losing sight of wanting to protect you because of it. There's usually a damn good reason, and sometimes many good reasons. And then it is more important than family. The church is everything. The church is more important than any relationship, anything else that you'd ever be involved in. Again, black and white thinking. There's room for you to only be an absolute adherent to the idea and follower of the idea that it is more important than anything, or you're engaging in blasphemy. And then this church is the one and the only form and source of truth, and the one and the only path to God. And so this isn't different. This isn't different from really any group that is run in this way. Religious groups that say the same things, people who are narcissistic in relationships who say, you'll never be able to get someone like me who is so incredible, or you'll never be able to find someone who loves you as much as I do, whether or not that really translates as love. But yeah, when you hear that this is the only source, the true way, the only way for you to get truth, and even in terms of pseudoscience and a lot of healing kind of cults and healers, if they say, I have the only path towards healing, that's when you want to run. You don't even have to run. You could just walk, but find the door and leave. What's also true is another absolute thought that happens in every cultic group, which is a complete intolerance for criticism or questioning. You need to believe absolutely. You need to believe 100%. And if you don't, it's punishable. And if you don't, it's the devil. And if you don't, it's your negative thinking. And if you don't, it's a lot of things that they're going to call a lot of things. But what I call it is critical thinking. You really do want to be able to hold on to critical thinking. And when you're involved in a group, when you're involved in a relationship with someone who says, don't ever question me, and I'm never wrong, then I want to offer you the same invitation. Please find the door and leave. That will be a place where you will be swallowed up whole, where you won't get to be you, where you won't get to use your mind. And for people who believe in God as a creator, God created your mind. So if you're involved in a church or any other religious group that tells you not to use it, they're barring you from using something that God gave you, which makes no sense at all. Take good care. Talk to you next week.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @indoctrinationpodcast. And for Twitter, find us @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're grinding out bicep curls, or muscling the couch across the living room, crushing morning miles, or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, Smoothie King has fuel to help you maximize your workouts, own your recovery, and elevate your game. Give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs with a lineup of delicious smoothies made to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.